It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're exploring what we can learn from the so-called Year of the Woman in 2018, considering elections at both the state and national level. Our colleagues over at WisconText dove into this, considering whether national trends were reflected by the number of women elected to the state legislature. Here is WPR host Darrell Connor talking with WisconText reporter and engagement editor Haley Sperling.
Haley, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Now, women made history in 2018 on the national level in terms of running for office and in being elected. So with that said, how did Wisconsin compare in terms of women being elected?
2018 was a really big year for women on the national level. There were a lot of firsts happening in Congress in terms of women being elected into office. But at the state level in Wisconsin, that wasn't necessarily the case. We didn't really break any big records. Nothing too exciting happened. It was just a lot more of the same.
Now, how do we compare to some of our neighbors around the Midwest, Minnesota, Illinois, and so on?
So compared to our neighbors in the Midwest, again, we rank pretty low when it comes to electing women to the state legislature. In my reporting, I compared the state legislature of Wisconsin to Minnesota, Iowa, Michigan, and Illinois, and found that Wisconsin actually elected the least amount of women in this past 2018 midterm election. So only about 23% of this new legislative class will come from this past election, whereas much of these other states are electing women at a much higher rate. So Michigan, for example, was the largest state for women for women to come out victorious, rather, with 36% of women candidates coming out on top. Again, we can kind of just see this pattern of Wisconsin not necessarily breaking any barriers or any boundaries when it comes to electing women to office. And it really just comes to a variety of factors that are holding people back.
So we know that Wisconsin is lagging behind our neighbors in terms of women getting elected to state office. But is the current number of women in office the most in Wisconsin's history?
No. So actually, there are about 27% of Wisconsin state legislature is now women. But that's, again, not at all very record-breaking or exciting. The years that Wisconsin elected, or the legislature, rather, had the most women were back in 1989 and 2003, which both held 28% women in the state legislature. So while this year was close at 27, it's still, again, not record-breaking, not historic in any way. To put this, you know, in perspective, the national average of state legislatures are composed of about 29% women.
Are Democrats doing better at electing women to the state houses or state, whether it's Senate or just the legislature in general, or are Republicans doing better?
So more women are definitely running as Democrats, but that doesn't mean that they're necessarily getting elected. And this can be attributed to a variety of factors depending on where you are. So in Wisconsin, this comes down to a matter of who the incumbents are, how the election maps are drawn, and a lot more. There has been a documented, you know, gender gap when it comes to voting patterns. Women tend to vote for Democrats, but in Wisconsin, for example, there were more than 50 Democratic women running on ballots in 2018, but only 20 of them were elected. And this is compared to, you know, 12 Republican women, but 11 out of those 12 actually came out victorious. So, again, it comes down to how the maps were drawn, who's actually coming out to vote, and the incumbents, because a lot of Wisconsin's incumbents, you know, state legislators happen to be men, and people tend to elect incumbents. And without that turnover, there's not going to be as many women in state legislature.
Haley Sperling is an engagement editor and reporter with WisConText. Now, you also, in your piece, covered the role of partisan gerrymandering in this. What does that have to do with whether women run for office?
So gerrymandering plays a really big role in a lot of different parts of elections. So Wisconsin, our election maps were drawn in 2011 by Republicans. And so it has been able to help bolster Republican candidates into victory when it comes to winning state offices. But compared to looking at a state like Illinois, where Democrats are in charge of drawing maps, more Democrats have been elected and things are coming out in a more even divide. Looking at a state like Iowa, where a nonpartisan committee actually draws their election maps, you know, things kind of break down in a more even manner. But, you know, in Wisconsin, again, the maps are drawn by Republicans to benefit Republicans. Again, the maps are not the only issue at hand, even if Democrats were able to go back and redraw their own election maps, because of how Democratic voters tend to be centralized within urban areas. It's a lot harder for Democrats, again, even if they were to draw their own maps, to come out as far on top as Republicans can, because their voting base is so much farther spread across suburban and rural areas as well.
What challenges do women face as they run for office, in particular in Wisconsin?
It comes down to even just recognition. The more women run for office, the more future women will run for office. And this is what a lot of sources had said to me. So now that, you know, so many more women kind of came out and are going for this, you know, these higher up positions, it will likely inspire more women to run. And, you know, the challenges can come down to a lack of time, a lack of knowledge on fundraising, on political campaigning, and just, you know, access to some resources that others might not have. In Wisconsin, there's a group called Emerge. It's a nationally based organization with a chapter in the state that helps Democratic and left-leaning women get into political office. So one thing that they do is, you know, emphasize getting in on the local and community level, because that is how women, you know, start to rise up. And if you don't have women starting out in city councils or school boards or whatnot, you know, they're not going to be able to rise into the state legislature. So it's important to note that nothing exists like that. In Wisconsin itself, nothing exists like that for Republican women. Republican women kind of come off at this disadvantage, you know, because there are a lot of places that are really, their sole purpose is to advocate for women in office, again, Democratic women in office. Nationally as well, you look at places like Emily's List that are huge, huge donors, huge advocates for women. But again, they're typically on the left side of the political spectrum.
Why do you suppose there isn't a Republican equivalent to Emerge?
So what I've heard from sources is that, you know, Republicans tend not to drive down the quote-unquote identity politics track and not necessarily invest into we're running women because they're women. And it's just, it's not to say that these groups don't exist anywhere. There are definitely PACs out there and some organizations that do help, you know, raise Republican candidates and groom women Republican candidates to win in their offices. But again, it's just not their fundamental party level and not necessarily ingrained into what they're doing. But, you know, this wasn't just a thing that Democrats have been doing for a long time. You know, Democrats and Republicans ran and elected basically the same number of women for decades, you know, and this pattern of stagnation kind of broke after the first quote-unquote year of the woman in 1992, and that's when Democrats kind of broke off and started electing more women into office while Republicans hovered around the same number.
Haley, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Haley Sperling is an engagement editor and reporter with WisConText.
Thanks, Darrell. That was WPR host Darrell Connor talking with WisConText's Haley Sperling about her piece, Why Wasn't 2018 a Big Election for Women in the Wisconsin Legislature? Coming up next, we'll continue our look at representation among elected officials by considering what we can learn from the record number of women elected to Congress. It's a look at the future of politics and representation. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're with us on the Ideas Network. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Last year was dubbed the second Year of the Woman. 1992 was also known as the Year of the Woman after the election of a number of female U.S. senators. Now, fast forward to 2018, where we saw a record 36 new women winning House seats. Women ran for office in record numbers. If you're thinking about running for office in the future, what did you take away from women who ran for state and federal office in 2018? What do you think women need to be successful as they campaign? And what about after they're elected? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can also join us on Twitter. We're at WPR Mornings and email ideas at WPR.org. Kelly Dittmar is Assistant Professor of Political Science at Rutgers University Camden and a scholar at the Center for American Women and Politics at the Eagleton Institute of Politics. She's the author of Navigating Gendered Terrain, Stereotypes and Strategy in Political Campaigns, and co-author of the book A Seat at the Table, Congresswomen's Perspectives on Why Their Presence Matters. Kelly, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We hear a lot about how 2018 was the latest year of the woman in politics. So let's take a moment for a refresher here on how women fared nationally in 2018.
Sure. So in 2018, we set a number of records, or we broke a number of records in terms of the number of women who filed to run for congressional offices, for gubernatorial offices, and then in terms of nominations, the number of women who are nominated for state legislative offices across the country was also a record. And again, those records were broken at the nomination stage congressionally and for governors. And then at the end of the day, obviously, we set new records for the percentage of women in Congress, the percentage of women in state legislatures overall. We did not set a record for the number of women governors. We're at 9. That's compared to a previous record. And then one other sort of point of context is that even though we busted through a lot of these records, this was largely a story of Democrats breaking records. This was not true for Republican women. And probably the starkest example of that is that at the congressional level in the U.S. House specifically, the number of Republican women went from 23 in the previous Congress to 13 in this Congress. So certainly it was an exceptional year for women overall, but the story really differs if you start to break it down a little bit by party as well as by state and level of office.
Well, let's turn to representation within the group of women elected to Congress. You were at an event yesterday, EPAC, with the aim of engaging, empowering, and elevating GOP women. What were some of the top takeaways from people who are thinking about how to bring more conservative women into politics?
Yeah, so you have to give a lot of credit to Congresswoman Elise Stefanik, who was the recruitment chair for the NRCC, the national arm of the Republican Party for the House, in the last cycle, and who really did make an effort to recruit more women, but struggled, faced a lot of barriers, and I'm sure she could talk more clearly about what those barriers were within the party, among voters, and just in the recruitment overall of women. And so for her, she really framed the event yesterday and her creation of this PAC as addressing a crisis. And the word crisis came up repeatedly from panelists throughout the day who were saying, we have to really define this problem of women's underrepresentation, extreme underrepresentation within our party at the congressional level, and then seek solutions. And in terms of solutions, the biggest solution that was repeated throughout the day was the need to provide Republican women candidates early money in the primary stage, that these organizations and the party can't afford to stay out of primary races because that's where we're losing Republican women, and it's also deterring some Republican women from running.
So as we saw these big gains on the national level, they were more focused on the Democratic side. But here, as we heard earlier in the conversation, women in Wisconsin on the state level, that's not mirroring what's going on nationally. Was this trend contained to the federal level, or did other places see gains within state representation of women?
Yeah, so it was pretty consistent, actually, nationally. And so obviously, in terms of how well Democratic women did, that varies by state based on what I think Haley was talking about in terms of gerrymandering and just the partisan dynamics of any given state. And so Wisconsin's interesting example of this, and it's something we did see in other states where you actually did have a record number of Democratic women running, but it was hard for them to make it through and be successful, right? And so that is the story for many states across the country, where if you look at the records for candidacies, you see that same trend, a surge of Democratic women running. But the challenge is how many of them could make it through. And so certainly at the congressional level, the Democratic women were probably more successful than they may have been in some of these districts before. But in some states, it was much harder for Democratic women to break through what are pretty red areas.
Talking with Kelly Dittmar, she's an assistant professor of political science at Rutgers University Camden and a scholar at the Center for American Women and Politics at the Eagleton Institute of Politics. You can join this conversation about women and elected office at 800-642-1234. Do you know a woman who ran or was elected to public office? What kind of work went into that? What did it mean for your community, your family? 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Kelly, why does representation of women matter? How does it affect legislative behavior?
So in the book that I recently released with my colleagues, Kira Sembamatsu and Sue Carroll, we interviewed 83 of the congresswomen from the 114th Congress. So that was two congresses ago, but it was nearly all of them. So over three quarters of the women who were serving. And we asked them this exact question, because I think it's important to really see from their first person perspective why it makes a difference that they are there. And I think they point to, and the book points to, sort of three baskets of places where it matters. One is sort of symbolically. So it matters that those of us who are looking at our political systems see people like us in them, whether or not that's because it inspires us to participate as potential candidates or simply just to have greater trust and faith that our views, our life experiences will be perceived in government. And so women we spoke with said they feel a sort of both honor and sense of responsibility to be that type of symbolic representative. Substantively, though, which I think people are most interested in, you know, the women said we bring distinct perspectives and life experiences to policy deliberation and dialogue. So whether that means they add issues to the agenda that would have never seen the light of day, or they just bring a different perspective to existing and important issues, whether it be immigration, criminal justice reform, economic policies like Social Security and how you deal with daycare and caregiving work. Women bring different life experiences because they are not living the same lives as men in the United States. We know that there are gender divisions of labor, there are gender challenges that are distinct to women and women of color. And so that's a really key part of a policy conversation that is missing if women aren't there. And then the last thing, sort of briefly, you know, they talked about the ways in which they approach this work differently. Women are motivated to get into office, we found repeatedly in our research, because they want to get things done. They want to make policy change. Men are also motivated by policy change, but in some of the research we've done previously on state legislatures, they also told us they're really motivated by the job, the title. And so that's going to change how they approach their work. When we interviewed the women in Congress, they said, look, we're focused on achievement over ego. And that means that we are sometimes more willing to compromise and collaborate because for us, the goal is to be effective, to make policy change. That's a hopeful sign for moving forward.
Well, let's zoom in there on collaboration, because there is research on how women govern in comparison to men. And according to that, women tend to be more collaborative and bipartisan. And as you said, they push for policies meant to support social welfare, women and children. So when they're in these executive positions and you know, looking at national security and other issues, how are we seeing women as collaborators? Where do you see that happening?
Yeah, I think we have to be very sort of honest about the fact that women are partisans just like men. And so especially in a highly polarized context, there are more limited opportunities for them to come together. That's something the women told us. We hear from women at the state legislative level and at the congressional level. So I don't want to overstate the idea that, you know, you get women in office and all of a sudden there's no partisan rancor. There surely is, because women, just like men, believe strongly, you know, in their views and their policy positions. But I think it's important to look beyond just the votes at the end of the day. So if you just measure, you know, how do members vote, you aren't going to find much bipartisanship in Congress or state legislatures. But I think the women we spoke to pointed to the ways in which that bipartisanship or collaboration can happen much earlier in the process. So as you're developing a policy agenda, or as you're developing an actual bill, a piece of legislation, are you bringing people from the other side of the aisle to the table to have those initial conversations? That's helpful, because then you hopefully produce legislation that could be passed in a bipartisan manner.
Talking with Kelly Dittmar, she's an assistant professor of political science at Rutgers University, Camden. You can join in 800-642-1234. And we want to know, women, did you run for office in the last election? Did you win? What happened? Call in, tweet us. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Last year, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez made history in becoming the youngest woman to be elected to the House. It is a victory which marked the inauguration of a new wave of progressive Democrats. And there were other firsts among this class of women, including Representative Ayanna Pressley, the first Black congresswoman from Massachusetts. Here's Pressley.
When it comes to women of color candidates, folks don't just talk about a glass ceiling. What they describe is a concrete one. But you know what breaks through concrete? Seismic shifts.
We're talking about the wave of women capturing seats on the national level and what happened here on the state level, as Wisconsin's legislature didn't experience the same type of gains. Were you a woman of color candidate? Did you run for office in the past? Tell us about your experience on the campaign trail. 800-642-1234. Kelly Dittmar is our guide. She's an assistant professor of political science at Rutgers University, Camden, and a scholar at the Center for American Women and Politics at the Eagleton Institute of Politics. Let's go to Paula now, who is joining us from the La Crosse area with her perspective. Paula, good morning.
Well, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. My story starts kind of about a year ago. I was elected, starting out very small, on a town board. And, you know, we're town board supervisors. And I actually ran. I replaced a woman, and she was the only woman on the board of five people. And I totally agree with everything the caller said, but another interesting point I was thinking about, and I did win. I did win. But it was funny. I think this. I was running against a man. And interesting, I wonder in towns and smaller communities, it's usually retired men that are running for these positions. And, of course, I'm still working full-time. My kids are grown and gone. But I did run against a man who was retired, and I won.
Paula, thank you for calling in with your perspective. Kelly, what about at that town level?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's so important. First of all, congratulations to the caller, to Paula, for, first of all, stepping up and then obviously being successful and doing it on top of a full-time job. I think there's an assumption that women fare better at the local level. I think when you just generally ask people, well, you know, what do you think women's representation is, that they'll presume that there are more women at that level. I think what Paula raised, noting that the woman before her was the only woman on the town board, that's actually, unfortunately, pretty common. And so it's important when we're talking about women's representation and increasing it to be focused at all levels of politics for multiple reasons, not only because it matters to have those perspectives in those local issues and conversations, but also because those those positions might lead to running for higher office. And so we want to both build the pipeline and also be sure that women's voices and a diversity of women's voices are evident across levels of office.
Oh, you're saying that this, at going from this level, you're able to kind of work yourself up into more and larger positions.
Right. And it's not always the case. Sometimes folks really want to focus on local level because that's where they care most about the policies being made. But certainly this can also then provide you some insights into the political system, can create a network for yourself so that when you have to fundraise for a higher level office, you know folks in politics. And most importantly, your community gets to know you so that when you're running for office, a higher level office, you already have a built-in set of base voters. So certainly it can be a pipeline to higher levels of office.
When we look at campaigns and races, in Paula's case, she was actually winning and replacing a woman, but many women candidates that ran, some of whom were elected, had the potential to be the first elected to their particular role. What are the pluses and minuses of being first?
Yeah. I mean, first of all, it's a good reminder to all of us that in 2018 and 2019, we're talking about first. So even though this was a great year for women, the fact that we're still talking about so many firsts means we have a lot of work to do. But I think, you know, the opportunities obviously are that you are most importantly, I guess, symbolically showing to voters, showing to other people who might share your identity that it's possible. And that's, you can't underestimate how important that is. But the challenges, of course, are that you're entering institutions that have largely been dominated by men and white men who haven't seen people like you. And that often raises levels of skepticism of your ability to do the job. You might have heightened scrutiny over the work you do because folks want to make sure that you know what you're doing and you're going to do it well. So we call that in the literature, it's called surveillance, right? So that you might have heightened surveillance. It sounds kind of scary, but of what you're doing. So those are the pressures that I think sometimes firsts are under because folks are really looking to them to see how other members of their shared identity group will do in the future. It's a sort of unfair bar, but I will say the women who have been the first have really taken it on and excelled and achieved and taken on the responsibility of speaking out and saying just how important it is to have more than there. So you look at Deb Haaland, the first Native American woman in Congress with Charisse Davids, or Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar, all of whom have been very vocal about the importance of having Muslim voices, Native American voices in Congress. So they've taken on the extra work that has come with being with the first.
Let's take a look at incumbents because there's a good chance that some of these women will run again. Do they tend to run again?
Yeah, we don't see drastic differences. Of course, this might vary by level and party and political context, but women win at the same rates as men, as incumbents, especially, you know, high win rates against incumbents. One thing that has been shown in some of the literature is that women might have more challengers to them. So folks might be more willing to challenge women, whether in a primary or general election. So that's something to look out for in terms of the heightened challenges that you might see for incumbent women. But certainly they stick around. And the fruits of that are that you then see women get into senior leadership positions. So it's not only important that we have women in office, it's important that they're in positions of power. So in Congress, obviously, we see Leader Pelosi, Speaker Pelosi in that sort of position. But also with the shift to Democratic power in the House, a number of women and women of color who are now committee chairs because of their seniority.
But last year, there was perhaps a little blip. 2018 had the highest number of women incumbents not returning since the Center for American Women in Politics started tracking in 2002. What's behind that?
Yeah, it's hard to point out in any single year why that is. Now, in 2018, some of those women were going on to run for governor and to run for other offices. So that is one reason. We saw, for example, Michelle Lujan Grisham become the governor of New Mexico, Kristi Noem become the governor of South Dakota. So we don't want to necessarily mark those off as, you know, women are leaving the system. In fact, they're using their position in Congress to lead to higher or different offices. But the other reasons are sort of, you know, some were there for a while, some just chose to leave, some were Republican women who perhaps may have seen that this was a difficult year to run for re-election as a Republican. We saw a number of Republican women lose. So I'm not sure there's something particular to 2018 that is generalizable across years, but you're right, it was a year where we lost a lot of incumbent women just at the start.
So looking forward, what do you think we can learn about the future of female candidates from looking back at the 2018 midterms? Where do we go from here?
Yeah, I think we have to be very careful in doing two things. One is not assuming that the job is done. So in all of the narrative about the surge, the wave of women, the pink wave, whatever we wanted to call last year, we have to remember that women are still under 25% of the members of Congress, under 30% of members of state legislatures, and over 50% of the population. So one thing to do looking forward is to remember that we have a lot of work to do to get closer to parity, which would be 50%. Of women in these offices. The second thing is to also remember that we have a lot of room for growth even at the candidacy stage. So we had a record number of women running in 2018, but again, they were still less than 25% of House candidates, for example. So we have to build that pool of women candidates. So that means keeping up the energy and enthusiasm and making an affirmative and positive case to women about why it matters that their voices are at the table. And that's specific to women of color as well. We need a diversity of women's voices and Republican women. We're never going to get to parity in one party alone. And so we need more Republican women in the pool. We need them to also be supported and successful so that we can reach parity overall for women across levels of office.
Before we have to let you go, we've seen a lot of exploratory presidential committees and campaigns starting up. What are you watching for there?
Yeah, I think it's really exciting to see that we're going to have a record number of women running for president this year. And what it also means is that when we talk about women candidates, I hope, for president, that we aren't thinking of some singular model. You know, how do you run as a woman candidate for president? This year, I expect we're going to have a variety of models by which women are running. And that means they're going to emphasize different policy issues, different traits or characteristics. They're going to have different styles. That goes a long way to pushing back against sort of monolithic conceptions of women candidates. So that's what I'm excited about, is that we'll see a real range of candidacies by women. And that forces us all to rethink some of our stereotypes about race, gender, and the presidency.
Kelly, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Kelly Dittmar is an assistant professor of political science at Rutgers University Camden and a scholar at the Center for American Women and Politics at the Eagleton Institute of Politics. Next up, we take a look at Native American women's representation in politics right here on the Ideas Network. We're looking closer at representation in state and national politics on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The congressional class of 2019 is the most racially diverse and most female group of representatives ever elected to the House. The first two Muslim congresswomen came into office, and we saw the first two Native American congresswomen secure a seat in the 116th Congress, which has kicked off. Here is U.S. Representative Deborah Holland of New Mexico weighing in on the effects of the government shutdown.
As someone who relied on government assistance programs when I was raising my daughter as a single mom, I've been there, and I know how they are going to pay for the, and I know that it is devastating for these people to worry about how they are going to pay for their next meal and take care of their families.
Are you a member of one of Wisconsin's tribal nations? Have you run for elected office? What was that race like? And if you won, what did that mean to your community? 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Let's bring in Deborah Barker now. She directs the American Indian Studies Program at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire. She's a professor of American Indian Studies and English. She is an enrolled member of the Rosebud Sioux Tribe. Deborah, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning.
Well, so two Democratic Congresswomen, Representative Deborah Holland of New Mexico and Representative Charisse Davids of Kansas, are the first Native American women elected to Congress. What do their elections say to you about representation?
It says to me that, first of all, the political action that's been galvanized across a range of Native nations is taking hold in a way that a lot of us find very heartening, because what it means is that that women and girls, and in fact all Native people, can see that they have access to the process and that they can provide not only representation but also visibility to the faces of Native America.
And there were among a record number of Native American candidates for office last year, according to NPR. How does increased representation affect future candidates, more in the pipeline?
Well, I think, first of all, looking at a couple of issues that have been discussed and that are crying for more attention, and that is the disproportionately high rates of violence and sexual assault against Native American women. And many of these assaults are by non-Native males. And I think that the rise of the women's movement again and the women's march has certainly played a role in that. But larger concerns, like environmental issues, for instance, and supporting regulations that combat climate change, fighting to preserve public lands, these are all huge issues now that I think can, you know, with further representation in the future, see some positive outcomes.
How are Native American voters looking at this changing, perhaps, political landscape? What are the issues they're watching for? And what have you heard in tribal nations about representation?
Well, I certainly cannot speak for Native people. I
sure.
can speak from my own point of view, and I think that it provides hope. From a broader perspective, because many of us have spent so many times having conversations with our elders about political activity among American Indians. In Deb Holland's case, for instance, 70 years ago, Native Americans in New Mexico weren't even allowed to vote. American Indians did not become citizens until 1924. So to see that now four Congress people are Native American at present, it really kind of heralds a new future for young Native people who are becoming increasingly more interested in and involved in national politics.
Representatives Holland and Davids joined two other Native Americans in Congress, Republican Representatives Tom Cole and Mark Wayne Mullen, both of Oklahoma. What do you hope for when you consider what representation of more Native Americans within Congress means when it comes to raising certain issues and policies?
It puts a face to these issues. It humanizes Native people, and this isn't a theme that I've returned to in my teaching so often, and that is that Native Americans have achieved kind of a mythological status, not of their own doing, in U.S. culture, in American culture. And I think that to have four Congress people who can put a face and to humanize these issues And to take this opportunity with these platforms to provide some basic education on the nature of trust responsibilities of the United States, of treaty agreements, and dispelling some myths. And the one myth that needs to be addressed over and over again is that the government provides welfare for American Indians, which is absolutely untrue.
You interact a lot with students in your classroom on these issues. What questions do they have overall, and where are the gaps in their knowledge?
The gaps in their knowledge happen all the way through their public school education, largely, if school districts are not enforcing the Act 31 mandate to provide American Indian education. So when we see students in our classrooms, many of them are absolutely shocked at what they're learning about the status of Native people in relation to settler colonial culture. And they're shocked that Native people are human. And I know that sounds like a pretty far-fetched sort of statement, but again, you know, by naturalizing or normalizing the presence of Native Americans on a public platform, that goes a long way to prompting greater interest and support for some issues that unite us all. And as I said earlier, environmental issues for starters.
Well, we heard just earlier, as you came on the program, Representative Deborah Holland of New Mexico having a real connection to this government shutdown. She's been there on assistance programs. What does that mean when a member of Congress has that in their background, that real connection to social programs?
She's not only an advocate, but she's a witness and a survivor. And she can provide a voice and a face for all those millions of Native Americans who don't have that kind of one-to-one representation. She's there to talk about the impact of the shutdown on health services, health clinics, and law enforcement and protection, the fire department, snow removal, funding for seniors, Head Start programs, Meal on Wheels. All of these federally funded programs are now slowly grinding to a halt. And like majority culture people are experiencing now and witnessing in the media, this is very adversely impacts Native Americans.
So, Deborah, where do we go from here? What are you watching for politically as we move forward and we look at representation and Native American voices in Congress and at the state level?
I'm looking forward to and will do my best to support a broader education in citizenry and greater support. I mean, we provide that at the university, that encouragement to learn more about political systems at the state and national level, and to even imagine themselves as stepping into an arena where they can be involved and they can make a difference.
Well, Deborah, thank you so much for joining us and bringing the perspective.
Oh, you're welcome.
Deborah Barker directs the American Indian Studies Program at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire and is a professor of American Indian Studies and English. Just ahead, winter can be a great time to look at the skies for Wisconsin's bird of prey, including the bald eagle, which has made a remarkable comeback in the state in recent years. We'll learn all about different kinds of birds of prey found throughout the state and how the populations are doing. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.